Our subject this morning is secrets of spiritual healing. There are two obvious segments to this topic. One is to use spiritual methods to heal ourselves physically, and the other, and more important, is the healing of our spiritual nature. Because disease is really threefold. Disease is of the body, the mind, and the soul. In this age, ever since Freud, we've become aware of the existence of mental disease as well as the physical, in addition to the physical. But the spiritual disease is something that people are not aware of except in their lack of peace of mind, in their dryness, in their lack of sense of meaning, of direction, and so on. And even though that the spiritual diseases or the basic disease of all, of ignorance, hasn't been defined as such in most people's minds, we're certainly aware of the consequences. We simply don't know how to seek the solution, because not knowing that as a disease, we think maybe the reason that we have a state of ennui or a sense of purposelessness or no peace is perhaps because we aren't eating right or aren't jogging regularly, or some purely psychological cause that doesn't touch the real cause, which is our ignorance of who we really are and why we're here. The ignorance of the soul, the ignorance of our spiritual nature and its ultimate reality. That's the source of all disease. So we'll come into that one after a bit. But first, the approach to physical disease, it's a very interesting thing how, first of all, let me preface it by explaining that Sri Yukteswar described the ancient system of yugas or ages in India as being a much smaller time span than is normally thought of, and that these ages take place within, we've come in present history out of the dark age of Kali Yuga into the next age of Dwapara. It's interesting, just sort of as a sidelight, because Sri Yukteswar stood alone on this point. Yet the definitions of Dwapara, of going into this higher age, are several. One is that people live longer. Another is that they are taller. A third is that they are conscious of matter as energy and not just as physical matter. And in all of these things, the orthodox concept is that we're gradually sinking further and further into Kali Yuga, or the Dark Age, and will continue to do so for another 200 and something thousand years. Rather a bleak prospect. But Sri Yukteswar said no. The original meaning was misunderstood and distorted. And in fact, Kali Yuga is only 1,200 years long, and Dwapara will be 24. And then there are two more ages. One, this age is the age of atomic energy, of demolishing space, of recognizing that matter is energy. And then the next phase, the next age, is Treta Yuga, which is an age of recognizing that energy, too, is only a manifestation of ideas, of consciousness, and mankind will be able much more easily then to, and much more normally, to communicate by telepathy. And then that age is 3,600 years, and the next one is 4,800 years, the golden age of spiritual enlightenment, where most people are aware of their souls and their relationship with God. Anyway, we have come since nearly 300 years ago into this age known as Dwapara. And the first 200 years of this age are a bridge, and therefore not the age proper. The age proper began with the beginning of this century. And in this century, suddenly man has become aware of energy. Man has become aware that matter isn't real except as a manifestation of energy. the old concepts of matter. There was a scientist in the 19th century who, complaining at many of the theories of newer scientists, was saying, if you can't show me a model of it, I can't understand it. That's Kali Yuga thinking. That's thinking that everything is form, everything is solid, everything is crystallized. And Kali Yuga, seeing matter as the ultimate reality, can't think in fluid terms, can't think in terms of the spirit behind the organization, the essence of truth behind the dogma, and so on. It lives by rigid rules, rigid dogmas, rigid structures. Everything in Kali Yuga is limited by this consciousness of form and matter. Now we've come into an age of energy, and everywhere we turn, we see not only the obvious fruits of energy in terms of electronics and automobiles and so on, but much more than that, there's a whole consciousness of energy now. We hear it in the music that's being written. We hear it in the fact that I was reading an interesting book. The name of it eludes me, but it's a new book on communities that work. It's put out by the people who started Yes Bookstore. Does anybody here remember the name of the book? What?
Seeds of Tomorrow.
And Ananda's the first community described in there, too. But it said that an interesting thing is that the communities that they contacted aren't, none of them, I thought we were unusual in this, but none of them seem to be very interested in rules. It's unusual and interesting because until now, practically, the greatest inspiration that monasteries, for example, seemed to get was from writing rules. And they would have all sorts of complex rules. The rule of Saint Benedict, I remember this curious one where at the table they would have a pulley arrangement where the bread would come. This was written in their rules, that it had to be done this way. The bread had to come in by this pulley so that they would get the feeling that it was descending from heaven. And but the concept that everything has to be done by rules, I've had people of the more orthodox view, the first thing they ask us about Ananda is, well, what are your rules? As if this defined our virtue, our validity. And the interesting point here then is that in all the communities that work, rules are practically non-existent. Custom is the supreme thing. That people find that something works, and there's enough social pressure in custom to make it work that way without there needing to be a rule, whereas if there were a rule, then you have all sorts of things like gossip, suspicion. It just becomes a totally different scene and not beautiful. Well, this too is a view of life as energy rather than form. Instead of thinking it has to be this way, well, if we're going in the right direction, it's bound to work out. And in fact, we see that it does work out, that people of goodwill getting together, giving them enough to do in a constructive way so they continue to be people of goodwill, it all works out without much trouble. And this is the sign of Dwapara Yuga, which is getting away from rigid institutions, rigid. Another interesting thing about these communities is that there has been quite a bit of sharing between them, rather than all saying ours is the only one and you must come this way and so on. Much more fluid, much more giving and receiving without taking. All of this relates to a consciousness of what has been called the New Age, a consciousness which is coming into the picture gradually in these times that we're living in. This is the first century of Dwapara Yuga proper. And why are we seeing so much upheaval on all levels? Because the old institutions don't, and never would, just gracefully bow out with a mumbled apology. they'll hang on for dear life. And so the old institutions resent the new. And just as a child growing into adolescence, gradually his clothes start to split at the seams. He can't wear them anymore. He's got to get new ones. And so our consciousness is growing, and the old clothes are splitting at the seams. We can't wear them anymore, and they're no longer suitable, but we try to hang on to them for sentimental reasons or for reasons of not knowing what the alternative would be, and assuming therefore that it must be worse, and so on. A lot of this is to be seen in the whole question of science versus religion. The challenge that science is given to spiritual and ethical values, it isn't really a challenge at all. I've made this point very strongly in my book, Crises in Modern Thought, that it's a challenge in one way. It's a challenge to broaden our perspective, but it isn't an undermining kind of challenge. It isn't a challenge that says that you are wrong. And yet many people have taken from the findings of modern science the belief, they've drawn the conclusion that the discovery of the relativity of matter, of motion and so on, that all this means that values too are relative. They forget, of course, that motion is relative to the speed of light. And our ethical values also are relative to something. They're relative, above all, to our search for true joy. All true ethical values are those which lead us toward joy. But people, confused by the findings of modern science, think that we've been introduced to a world that's meaningless simply because it doesn't mean what we thought it meant. And that we think that life has no purpose, that there's no value, that all values are subjective. One psychologist wrote what to him was a rhetorical question: has man evolved more in producing a brain than the elephant has evolved in producing a trunk? Ridiculous question, but in the context of survival, perhaps not. It's just that survival, obviously, then can't be the sole issue. But the point is that all the old ways of doing things are beginning to be undermined, and we're in that transition stage where we haven't yet found many of the new ways. And in medicine, this also is true. I was reading an article, and I think I mentioned this here in a recent class, about it was a scientific investigation of the rhythms of poetry and their compatibility with the rhythms of the normal rhythms of the brain. And they found that in all countries, in all cultures, the rhythms of normal poetry, a set line of poetry ending with a rhyme that causes the mind to pause before going on to the next one and so on, that all of this corresponds actually with the way the brain rhythms function, and that free verse is disruptive. And it's either disruptive or it isn't taken in, it isn't remembered. You can remember a rhythm metered poem much better than you can Walt Whitman, where a line will go on for several lines before you finally take a breath. And in fact, that's an interesting point, that in our understanding of human nature, we're coming more and more into very subtle realizations of the rhythms, the left and the right brain, for example, the rhythms of the energy in the body and how it normally works. And I think that we're going to find that within about 100 years, that medicine has changed so much that it'll no longer be equated with drugs at all. It will be equated with energy. It'll be equated with many much more subtle ways of treating the body. And this is, I think, basic to all healing even now. It isn't really, no system of drugs or therapy works for everybody. What really seems to work is that system which brings the response from the person. And some people will respond to one thing or another, possibly also because of their expectations of response. They've discovered in working with drugs that any time they put a new drug out on the market, they will test it first with a control group and a non-control group. And they've found that giving one group nothing but placebos and the other group the drug, that the people with placebos will work for them almost as well as the people who take the drug. And they're satisfied that the drug is effective if there is a percentage of, if it's 10% more than those who are helped by the placebo. It's not much of an average. They found that many people are cured just because they expect to be cured. But we haven't yet drawn the complete conclusion from this. Norman Cousins wrote a very popular and famous book because he was dying of an obscure kind of cancer which nobody could cure. And he was able, by listening to humorous stories and reading humorous books and laughing, and he found laughter the best therapy of all, he was able to cure himself. Well, this has been proved true, that many times simply being happy will cure things that the doctors can't touch. Here again, we're touching on something very central to the issue of energy. Energy is the real cause of cure in all cases. That which enables the energy to function best will be the most effective cure for the individual. But ultimately, the direct source of energy is the infinite, not whatever you're taking from outside, food or oxygen or whatever. But the energy that's all around your body that you can draw into your body by what Yogananda said was willpower. He said the greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. And the will is tied to willingness. It's not a grim, tense kind of thing, but willingness, joy, in other words. When you're willing to do something, when you do something willingly, you do it with joy. Joy is a kind of willingness. And anything that will bring your energy up, like people taking a placebo and thinking this is going to help them, even that brings a certain level of energy up, which then is able to cure them. This energy is a conscious kind of energy that will be able, if you send it to the parts of the body needing it, will be able to do its work without the direct intervention of your own understanding. You send energy to a part that needs help, and you don't need to know the mechanics of how it needs to be helped. The energy is that which has enough consciousness to be able to bring things into further alignment or perfect alignment. But it all comes back to this question of energy and of that which will help one to draw that energy, to awaken a response of energy in the body, to say yes to life, for example. Yogananda said a very interesting thing. He said that all disease, metaphysically speaking, is caused by a conflict between the forces of the soul moving upward and the forces of matter moving downward. That's a very interesting thought, that if you could get all the energy flowing in an upward way, then you would find an extraordinary power of healing. An important point to remember is that karma enters into this picture. This is something that most Western people concerned with healing don't take into account. That the if it's your karma to have a particular problem, then it may require a great deal more of the right kind of problem to be able to offset that. It's sort of like many of you saw the slideshow that I showed last Tuesday. And incidentally, I'll be showing my last slideshow this next Tuesday, and it'll include a long sequence. In fact, maybe it'll turn out to be the whole thing, I don't know, but on people. I call it Different Worlds. because it's people all around the world, just close-ups of different states of consciousness and so on. And I hope it'll be interesting. It jolly well should be. There are some interesting pictures. So anyway, I had these pictures of Mexico that I had taken in their rainy season in September or October, and it was very humid and very hot, and the film was pretty well ruined. It was all so very red and very underexposed, and I had thrown them away because they were not worth showing. I never showed them to anybody, but Kalyani insisted on keeping them. And then I got this slide duplicator and started working with it and realized that I could save some of these totally ruined shots. And so I asked for them back. Well, it was a very interesting experience that I had. I found that these shots were so red that I couldn't eliminate from I have a balance of magenta, cyan, that means red, blue, and yellow. And with the balance, I can do a great deal in recreating a lost slide. What made that sequence interesting to save was that it showed land that I had almost bought when Ananda came along. So it had been a toss-up between getting that in Mexico and this place here. If I'd gotten that, Ananda would never have happened. I'd have just sat there in my little plot of land under a waterfall writing. But anyway, I couldn't reduce the red below zero, and there was still a great deal of red when red was at zero. So what I did was increase the blue and the yellow to outrageously high degrees, and then the amount of red that was there but was in a normal balance with the blue and the yellow. And it made it look as if it was a perfectly normal picture just taken over again. And I showed you the example. It's quite amazing. Well, the same thing here in healing. If we can increase the positive side, if we can increase there's a certain amount that we can't go below. In karma, for example, that karma may be so strong for you to have a particular physical problem that it's only when you've increased the energy much higher relative to it that it finally is weak. You can't push it out of the way. You can't suppress it. Drugs have their nature is usually to suppress something, and in the suppressing, you can't suppress beyond a certain amount. And besides that, as you try harder to depress it, you begin sort of bleeding over into other aspects of your physical needs, so that they have what are called side effects. And it would be a far more scientifically justifiable thing to try to increase the energy, try to increase the positive thinking, try to increase the other sides that are wholesome to such an extent that the other no longer has any kind of influence. This, of course, medical science is not at the point now where they can do it. They can't be teaching their patients the energization exercises, for example, very easily. They do try to tell them to a certain extent to smile, but it's pretty hard to smile if you don't know the secrets of happiness, if you don't know the secrets of meditation, of being in tune, of lifting your nature, and so on. All of these things are the spiritual aspect of healing, however, that the more you can live in God, the more you can live in a higher state of consciousness, the more naturally things will go well with you. That doesn't mean they'll always go well, and it's no more a test of your spirituality not to be ill than it's a test of your spirituality always to find a parking place. It's much more complex than that. But there is something there. There is something there that you will certainly find, that the more you live in a higher state of consciousness and live by that energy, the more your physical problems simply will begin to disappear. The essence then of spiritual healing is to live by that energy, this is what it's going to be more and more in the future. I think that, in fact, I'd love to really get into experimentation on these things. For example, the aura. If the aura is strong, then physical problems are much less likely, or perhaps not at all likely, to come to you. How do you increase the aura? That would be much more important than fending off the problem. You get rid of one enemy on this side, and then another one comes from the left, and you get him, and somebody's there from the back. You learn how to handle guns, and then you've got to deal with cannons. And always, it's just one thing after another, whereas if you can create a sufficiently impregnable fortress, none of these things will be able to come. Besides which, thinking of guns, you get the consciousness of bullets, and automatically attract that problem, whereas thinking of light and a strong aura and joy, you don't think about these things, and that too tends not to draw them to you. So how do you increase the aura? This would be a very interesting thing to work on. We've seen here, and it's much more than physical health, it's a matter of all levels. For example, accidents, misfortunes. Somehow at Ananda, it's just an incredible thing the way everybody has been protected here on all levels. In the way of accidents, in the way of disasters, always something always seems to come along and everything works out for the best. And the reason for that is that the aura, the psychic manifestations are, or emanations are of a much more positive caliber. So if you can learn to live in joy, if you can learn to strengthen your aura, living with other people certainly strengthens your aura too, other people who are on the path. Techniques of even doing the yoga postures and trying to use your hands magnetically to strengthen the aura is very beneficial. I'd love to experiment with things like color therapy. I think that the thing is, you see, in this day and age, we still want quick results. We're so used to quick fixes. And yet, sometimes those things which take a much longer time are much surer in the long run. We don't know at what point a person's aura will be strong enough to evade a trial that we can't imagine anyway. It's all very vague. All we know is that the stronger the aura becomes, the more everything seems to flow well. And so color therapy is, people usually only think of therapy once they're ill. They don't think in terms of long-term cures and treatments. But in fact, we ought to start with these things from the very beginning. We should eat right. We should teach children to eat right. We should not indulge in those kinds of sports that in later years are going to punish our bodies for having done them. We should always think in terms of being long-distance runners. And so something like color therapy might indeed not be something to use once you've got a real problem. It might or it might not be. But to use color to affect the aura, I think that there must be something to this. Wearing gemstones is a very interesting way that the ancient yogis discovered for keeping a person fit. The gemstone depends upon your horoscope and the planets that are weak and the planets that need strengthening and so on. It's an exact science, and not just your birthstone according to the month you were born in. But there is definitely something to that. And an interesting thing was that the gem bangle that I wear, somebody did something to align the molecules and so on in this bangle. And the moment I put it on, I could feel the difference. It was very, very surprising. You'll find that there are some stones that are happy stones and other stones are unhappy stones. Many people have had this experience with stones, that they just feel very drawn to some and others really put them off. Some stones, according to the lore at least, are unfortunate stones. The Hope Diamond is considered such an example. It's not an easy subject to examine scientifically because it's so subtle. But nevertheless, yogis have said that if you will wear a stone that's right for you, it should be at least 2 carats, it should be relatively faultless, and probably a decent color is helpful, although they don't speak of that, and it should be worn touching the skin. This can be definitely helpful in helping to strengthen the aura and help you to live more in this light. These bangles that Yogananda recommended too, of gold, silver, and copper, which we many of us wear here, are very helpful for this. And I remember one disciple of Yogananda's was having accidents, was accident prone. Yogananda suggested he wear one of these bangles. So it isn't only for the body, it's for the aura, it's for your mental health, it's for many things. Well, all of this ties in to a different approach to healing than the one that we're accustomed to in our culture today, and particularly in America. I know that doctors in Europe feel that the American doctors are much too prone to think of the body in terms of it's just being a mechanism, like a car in a garage that you change the carburetor, and every carburetor for that model should work on every one of that particular model of car. But it doesn't work that way with man. We are a mental being and a spiritual being, not just a physical, and that's why the same thing that will work with one person won't work for another. So physical healing, the secrets of them all, there are many, many techniques, but all of them relate back finally to that which will help to increase or unleash your hidden energy. A man I know, he was the SRF center leader in Mexico City. Many years ago, his brother, who was a doctor, told him that he was very anemic and needed to eat meat. And he said, "Well, no, I'm a vegetarian, and I don't want to eat meat." And the brother said, "Well, you'll die if you don't." And so this friend of mine refused to. Well, the brother then got another doctor to come in, thinking maybe he'd listen to another doctor because he wasn't related to him. And the other doctor was even more severe about it. But this man said no, he wouldn't do it. And so they gave up. Anyway, what he did was he sat in the window of his home with his arm in the sun. And he would just very deliberately and consciously, rubbing his arm in order to make him more conscious of it, draw energy from the sun into his body. And then other parts of his body he'd put in the sun and do the same thing with. After 6 months, he was completely well. And the doctors said, "Well, you see, finally you did take our advice." And he didn't say anything. But Yogananda used to say that a great deal of healing power comes to us through the rays of the sun, and that those rays can become 100 times more effective if we concentrate on them and don't just sort of lie there and go to sleep. Concentrate on drawing those rays to you. What you will do is increase 100-fold your own ability to receive those rays. It's not as if by concentrating suddenly, boom, they all come deflected to your body. But your ability to receive them becomes increased that much. Another very important method for drawing energy into the body is through deep breathing. But again, if you do it consciously, one method would be to, I think if I recall correctly, you put your hands behind your head. At any rate, you lean down with your head between your knees and then inhale slowly and feel that you're filling your body with air from the feet all the way up until you come here like this, all the way up to your head. Or the deep breathing exercise in our yoga posture system, where you lean forward and inhale slowly and bring the arms up and extend them up above the head and feel that you're filling your whole body with energy. You get a lot more energy out of the oxygen that way than just by breathing absent-mindedly. Anything that you can learn to do consciously will be enormously beneficial for you. So, strengthening your energy, strengthening your aura, strengthening your willingness, learning to say yes to things and not always to be reluctant. Learn to be willing to do whatever has to be done. This would be another interpretation, albeit a little bit extended from its more central meaning, of what Jesus said when he said that if a person makes you go a mile, go with him 2 miles. In other words, if you have to do it willingly, do it joyfully, do even more, rather than have that thought, well, I have to do this. The more you can learn to say yes to life, to say yes to whatever needs to be done, the more you will find that you are living always in a state of high energy and physical fitness. So I think that we are on that kind of the cusp of that kind of change in medicine, that it'll happen in many ways. For example, in hospitals, they've learned since quite a long time now that the sort of antiseptic white depressed people, whereas colored walls made them feel better and they got better faster. Music. They've listened. There's one doctor who found that playing in his clinic that tape that Jeannie and I made, Rainbows and Waterfalls, that patients were reporting that they felt much better as a result of it, and so many of them were buying this tape. And music of a soothing nature, music of a calming nature, can be very, very beneficial. And I think a lot more is going to be done in these terms, that we go into the schools and help children to be well who aren't ill yet. Teach them how to do things to make them just well as a habit, rather than the stopgap measure that we have today, where as soon as the pipe bursts, we rush and fix the pipe, and then wait for it to burst again and rush and another emergency call, and the plumber comes and fixes another hole. But why not change the pipe? Why not get a kind of pipe that won't burst holes in the first place? And this is what we're talking about. Preventive medicine, preventive measures. Lifting the consciousness upward. Kriya Yoga. One doctor in Mill Valley, I think it was, he was a Kriya Yogi himself, and therefore he dealt with a number of other Kriya Yogis as patients. And he said that he found that those who practiced Kriya were by and large more healthy than other people. The reason being that they rotate that energy in the spine and bring the body into a normal energy balance so that everything starts to flow as it ought to. The Kriya Yoga practice helps to overcome these blocks that make nature fight against itself. As Yogananda said, the upward moving and the downward moving energies in the body being the ultimate metaphysical cause of disease. Disease, however, is not just physical, and from what I've been saying, we can see how important it is to have, for example, a healthy mind. Because if you don't have a healthy mind, then you won't be happy, you won't have all those attitudes that will enable you to bring energy into your body, which are willingness, joy, enthusiasm, an ability to laugh. All these things relate to sanity, relate to an ability to see things in their proper proportion. It was a very interesting thing in the life of the great humorist P.G. Woodhouse. He was arrested by the Nazis and put in a concentration camp. And afterwards he made some broadcasts to his public here in America, and he was totally innocent. He was politically completely naive. And anybody after reviewing his broadcast realized that there was no political substance to them at all. But what made him really put him in a position where the English were incapable of understanding him was his ability to just sort of smile at the whole experience. It was not a happy experience, it was a difficult one, but he always found something to laugh at. As in a book that I read about him recently, it said that it tried to probe the secret of his real nature, because usually when people are cheerful, you assume that there's something dark underneath it all. And the conclusion of this analysis was that behind the happy mask was a happy man. But it was a very interesting thing that the English weren't capable of laughing at after all, it's hard to laugh at such times, but he had that amount of sanity that made it possible for him to laugh even while he was going through considerable privation in the concentration camp. So all of this requires a mental balance. To be able to have that kind of attitude that will heal the body requires first that you heal the mind. But how can you have a happy mind in the long run when you see so much darkness, when you see so much pain? You can't just laugh it off forever. It's there, and when it really hits you, it's much harder. And whereas P.G. Wodehouse did have an extraordinary, I think he must have been a great deal more spiritual than he ever would recognize in himself. I know he used to say that mankind would be one message short when he died, because he didn't have any message. But in fact, he did have a message, and it was something that he expressed all the time. Just a constant vision of goodness in man because he was good, and of laughter because he was happy, and he could see the underlying reality of things, I think, better than most people could. I really think he must have been a great man, because it takes greatness to be able to be so consistently cheerful in the face of sometimes real adversity. But the thing is that as we learn to as we confront sorrow and difficulty and cruelty and inequity and so on, there has to be some level within us. Whether he found that level or not, it's not my competence to say. But I can certainly say it for the majority of people, that you can't be looking at things that are dark and just laugh. You, on some level, you can just say, well, all right, I refuse to let it touch me, and therefore I'll laugh. But you can't laugh for them. You can't laugh when it hits you, unless you have something more, and that's spiritual consciousness. You can't have a healthy mind, truly, for long at least, until you have a healthy soul. Until you have a healthy relationship with your soul, perhaps I should say, because the soul's always healthy. It was a very interesting conversation I had with Master one time, with my guru. I was asking him about my earthly father. And I said, I wanted to know how he was spiritually. I said that he's very honest and honorable and kind and truthful and all sorts of virtues that he has, but he doesn't, as far as I can see, he doesn't think about God or seek any kind of spiritual values. And Master's single comment on that was, "The road to Hades is paved with good intentions." Rather a harsh answer, and yet a very true one. Because sooner or later, if you don't include spiritual realities, something will come along that you won't be able to rise above. My father was very courageous, tremendous strength of character and willpower. But in his last year or so, he encountered illness that left him totally incapacitated. If he fell down, as happened once or twice or three times, he was incapable of lifting himself up. He had to simply wait there until somebody came. And he couldn't even get to the phone to call anybody. So once he had to lie there for quite a while before somebody came. Mother wasn't there at the time. And it made him so helpless that I used to see him weeping. I couldn't ever have imagined him weeping, but he would weep at his own helplessness, at the fact that everything was just slowly shutting down. He couldn't see, he couldn't hear, he couldn't taste, he couldn't feel, and just finally it all shut down altogether and he left. But it was interesting too, when I felt his spirit after death, there was that same youthful courage and strength that he'd had as I'd known him as a boy. But the thing is that he didn't have spiritual strength. He had human strength. He had strength of character. But it didn't bring him to that level of wisdom that enabled him to meet successfully the test that he encountered later in life. And no man will be able to do so merely on strength of character. There's a point beyond which your human strength fails you, unless you have also spiritual strength. And that strength comes from meditation. That strength comes from being in tune with God. The whole, as I said, the spiritual disease is the disease of ignorance, of not knowing who you really are, of not being in touch with your higher nature. Now, the way to live in this kind of consciousness, it isn't possible just by affirmations, just by living a good life, just by trying to be spiritual without meditating and without letting God do it. You can't do it on your own. What you have to do is be able to reach that point where you can mentally offer it up into the light. Jesus said, "He who would save his life shall lose it. He who would lose his life for my sake shall find it." He was talking of not your physical life only, but the thought of your own life, your ego. If you can reach that point where you can offer it up, lose his life for my sake doesn't mean merely being a martyr. Not many of us get the chance to be martyrs, but to offer your life up into the superconscious, to offer your ego up into the superconscious, to be able to receive God and let him act upon you instead of doing it all yourself. This is the only way that you can really overcome your human delusions, your human illnesses. And that comes by meditation. Meditation is absolutely essential for a person who wants to overcome his spiritual disease. This being the core is absolutely essential for everybody anyway. Because until you overcome that ignorance, sooner or later, things just will stop going right for you. Sooner or later, you will suffer. Sooner or later, the actions of the past, or the mass karma of the people around you, whatever it might be, sooner or later these things will hit you, because life is not, it's not possible that it be a continual curve upward. Life is an ocean with waves going up and down and up and down. And the higher the wave, the higher, the greater the crash when it comes. They say, for example, with the San Andreas Fault, that the longer it takes for us to get an earthquake, the worse the earthquake will be. They say that with the stock market, that the longer it takes for this depression to come, the worse it will be. Because the corrections, you can correct a little bit artificially, but the realities still keep building up to the point where finally there's nothing you can do about it, and then the crash is many, many times worse. That's why many people say that it's much better not to try to control the economy. Let it have its own corrections. The corrections will be much less painful in the long run than the big correction that comes when things just get totally out of control. What can you do, for example, with an economy that's a couple of $1 trillion in debt? There's a point beyond which you just can't kid yourself anymore, and it finally collapses. We're heading in that direction, and there's just nothing we can do about it. But if we could make the corrections bit by bit, all the better. Don't think that your life is always going to be on an upward curve. It can't be. The very nature of things is such that there will always be corrections. There will always be opposites. Things will always fluctuate from one extreme to the other. And unless you can live calmly at your center, you will go out of control too. And you'll suffer even at both ends. People who live fast lives thinking to overcome pain are actually suffering even while living their fast lives. They're suffering from ennui, they're suffering from nervousness, they're suffering from loneliness. I remember a couple of millionaires with whom I rode to Taxco from Mexico City years ago. And They were the employers of a friend of mine who had, whom I'd gone down to Mexico with, and they were giving us a weekend. Well, I never drove so fast in my life. They were driving, but I never went so fast in my life as with those guys. They were driving like madmen down these winding curves to Taxco, and they got to Taxco, and after a half an hour, they couldn't even finish their lunch before. They were so restless that they had to leave the table and get in their car and drive back, and we just decided to stay. But this doing so much, you get so nervous that finally you can't enjoy anything at all anyway. They say that suicides are greater among millionaires, more numerous among millionaires, proportionately speaking, than among paupers. Because they have everything, and yet they find they have nothing. Well, what's the answer then? The answer is to cure your spiritual disease above all. And if this requires, in the short life that we have, putting more energy into the spiritual and less into the material, that's wise. Don't put too much, because if you die of disease at the age of 30, you'll have missed the golden opportunity of living to do these things. But at the same time, remember what your priorities are. If the secret of physical health ultimately is mental, and then even more so spiritual health, then your main concentration should be on meditation, on being in tune with God, and not thinking too much about the body. This is true also for people on the path who want to devote a great deal of time to the yoga postures. I've seen so many people who are really strong on yoga postures that they devote all their energy into a sort of competitive fury, trying to bend their legs that little extra inch that makes all the difference, because nobody else can bend it quite that far. And all these different pretzel shapes and these difficult postures that they can assume and so on, it's not balanced, it's not right. And no yogi worthy of his salt would recommend it. In fact, most yogis say don't practice too many postures. Do some, they're good for you, but don't waste time on too much. Don't waste too much time on the body. Some people devote so much energy to fasting and all sorts of physical methods of being well, and yet I don't find that people who put all their energy into that are even happy. They're always worried about some new little fad, some new cure-all. No, put most of your energy into God. Realize that sooner or later you're going to have to drop this body anyway. One man said to Yogananda, I've cheated St. Peter three times with carrot juice. And Yogananda said, listen, when St. Peter wants you, he'll take you. You could bathe in carrot juice, it won't do you any good. Some people think that they'll be able to live forever if they do rebirthing or different things, but I don't see them doing it. I see over the years they're getting bald, and their teeth are going bad, and their eyesight's failing, and who's to say that they're going to be able to keep it up? The fact is that they aren't. It's really a delusion to try to give too much energy to the ultimate result rather than concentrating more deeply on the cause. Live in the consciousness of the divine. Remember Swami Pranabananda when he visited Ranchi, and Master said that your body is getting old and your faculties are failing. Are you still able to say, as you said years ago, that you have two pensions, the one of bliss and the other of pension from the company you'd retired from? And Pranabananda said, my beloved is always with me. In other words, he was still living by that inner pension. And so it is we should look at the example of the saints. They're not worried about their bodies getting old. They're worried about their spirits getting young. And that's not a worry, but it's a concern, it's a preoccupation. They're thinking more and more of living in the ever new flow of God's love. And so concentrate first of all on your spiritual life. Concentrate first of all on meditation, thinking about God. Then with a bit of time that you have left, concentrate on right attitudes, because those are very important for attaining these spiritual realities. Without right attitude, sooner or later you'll fall from them. And then concentrate on the body. Give it its due, but don't give it more than its due. Yogananda said that some people are so addicted to the body that they'll say, oh, I didn't get my avocados this morning, my spine feels weak. And it's not wise. So energy. Concentrate on living more consciously. Live more by the thought of that inner energy, always draw on it consciously by your willpower. In other words, nothing happens absently, but if you walk consciously, if when you're with people, you be conscious of what they're doing. We passed Mark Dial this morning on the road, and I was noticing that I didn't know, because he didn't look like anybody who lived at Ayodhya. I didn't know that whether he was a person from Ananda or not, looking at him from behind. But I thought, well, he looks so conscious, he must be a member of Ananda. and I passed him, and there I saw, yes, in fact, he was. But it's so that when you're on the path, you begin to be conscious. You don't just sort of go absent-mindedly from one place to another, like people on the subway. I remember going on the subway in New York and being surrounded by these people all sort of hanging from their straps. And they were obviously just sort of existing until they reached their particular goal, in which case they would come to life and get out. But the more you live in that way habitually, the less to life you come. So that even when you come out of the subway, you're still sort of lurching through the streets or whatever, but you look at people, they develop a habit of unconsciousness. They're sitting here sort of enduring it all until it ends. You don't see very many people walking the streets of our cities looking really alert. When you do see them, it's a wonder, it's a joy. But people try to clamp down and sort of endure it all. Try to overcome your suffering by joy, not by numbing yourself. Try to overcome your disappointments by joy, by love. Try to overcome the fact that people don't treat you right by treating them even more right. And it will work in time. It will work eventually. It will work if only because you'll start attracting people who can appreciate you and what you're putting out, and stop attracting people who don't. Don't just fight it all the time, but just put out the right energy. I was intrigued by a slight example this morning. Here I was sitting here trying to meditate, and there was this fly that kept dive-bombing my ear. And, what's that?
There's one in the temple, perhaps the same one.
It's probably the same one, yeah. And, naturally, once it finally lands, you're sort of afraid that from here it'll hop inside the ear. And so you think, no, I've got to do this, and so I didn't. Then I thought, well, if he's so determined to settle on my ear, let's get this desire out of his system. And so I let him do it, and he just sat here for a while. And finally, he decided, well, he'd done that, and there were greener fields to search. And so he never came back. Oftentimes, I think that if we can just put out the right kind of energy instead of fending off the wrong, somehow things right themselves. It's very interesting how very often that proves to be true in life, too, that when you fight something, it fights you. When you worry about something negative, it keeps getting more and more negative and keeps jabbing you. Like Norman, who at Mount Washington couldn't get along with another disciple called Jerry. And finally, largely because of Jerry, Norman left the monastery. And he came back a year later and told me ruefully, "You remember how I couldn't stand Jerry? Where I work, there are six others exactly like him." And I don't know whether the karma itself becomes bigger because you fight it. Perhaps that's part of it, but it may also be that you become smaller, and so it seems bigger. But whatever it is, if you can learn to, instead of worrying about, just like with disease, you take drugs to suppress the disease, if instead you could become stronger in yourself, if instead you could rise above it, if you could put out the right kind of thoughts to people, so that if they are unkind to you, if they treat you cruelly or unfairly or whatever, instead of feeling what a rotten world this is that produces people like this, or instead of getting all angry at this person, if you would just say, no, I feel better loving than not loving, and so I will love all the more. I will be all the more kind. And there are people who will take advantage of that. But you'll find that if you live by this principle, and you don't need to be a doormat, you can answer sharply sometimes, but don't feel it in your heart. However you are in your behavior, because this is all that they'll understand, don't be that way here unless it's positive. But you'll find that bit by bit, you will reach the point where you will attract either the right attitude from them, or they'll move on out of your life. And other people will come who will understand, will react according to the kind of magnetism you've put out that drew them. So, all healing comes down finally to being in tune with God. The ultimate disease that we want to cure is our separation from Him. And you can have the healthiest body in the world, and what will it give you in terms of what you're really looking for? It will give you good health, yes. Will it give you happiness? Very probably not. I've seen very few really health-minded people who are very happy. Their minds are on something physical. They become... I remember a woman who was very gung-ho for La Leche League and breastfeeding. And somehow her consciousness was so engrossed in this thing, which is a perfectly good thing in itself, but I don't see any point in focusing your entire existence on something like that. And I must say that somehow she seemed to me sort of like a baby factory. Her whole mind was just on this one subject. And how much better it would be if your mind could expand to include other things that saw good health and good physical practices and so on as good, but within a larger context. So to be happy is something that requires a state of mind, it requires an affirmation, it requires a state of consciousness, of attunement. And the more you live in that practice of meditation, the practice of... See, yoga is good too, but not if you practice it only from the standpoint of techniques. So many people worry about doing the breathing exercises and doing the postures and doing all these various other things that they don't think twice about getting angry with other people or being proud or so on. I've seen even famous yoga teachers who stand there proudly before their classes like this, and what have they got? You can train your body to do many things, but monkeys can do some of them better. Elephants can do others of them better. Horses can do some things better. This doesn't make you God realized. Concentrate then on living in God. This is the whole secret of spiritual living, of well living on all levels.